Let me get the thank you. Somebody's getting the doors in the back. Appreciate that. So here's what we're going to do. We made the decision, Rebecca and I made the decision 5 or 6 years ago, I guess, that when we saw a statistic that people had asked, were asked, hey, if you had trouble in your marriage or trouble parenting issues or whatever, where would you go? And the local church did not make the list, the top 100 on the list. And so to realizing that's ridiculous, but it's kind of our fault. We've accepted this dichotomy that the secular world has created between religious life and real life, that there's real life, and it involves things like math and science and work and family and that kind of stuff. And then there's religious life, and religious life is about believing in things that you know aren't really true. And so that's kind of the dichotomy. And so we said, well, that's absurd and isn't true and needs to be changed. So one of the things we decided to do is we always take a few weeks every year and do an emphasis on marriage and or parenting issues, and especially the biblical principles behind that. And then, of course, I have the advantage of being a licensed therapist and having 15 licensed therapists who work with me. And so next week, you'll have the opportunity, Millie Tanner, who's one of my therapists at Aletheia. Many of you have seen her as a therapist. She is who Ginger calls when Ginger has marriage problems. She calls Millie. And so some of you know absolutely I'm not joking. The rest of you just think I am. And so Millie's going to be here and share some great principles, especially in regards to conflict and conflict resolution stuff next week. And then the next week after that, we're going to talk about how having a great marriage is a powerful part of being a great parent and or grandparent, for example. And so it is and I'll give a testimony to that and talk about that big time. And then the next 2 weeks after that, then the week after, so that will be in 2 weeks. And then third week, we're going to talk about the basics of parenting, just some very good, basic, general principles of parenting. And then the next week will be how to handle adolescence and having adolescence in your home and that kind of stuff. And so, and some other probably Aletheia counselors and maybe some of the staff will step in at different times. And so you could get lots of different resources for this, which is just a huge blessing that we have here. So here's where I'm going to jump in. I'm going to pray, and then I'm going to jump in and talk just a couple of quick things about this, and we'll get started with that. Father, thank you for the opportunity to gather together in your Son's name. I thank you personally that your word is living and it is active. It is not less applicable to our lives today than it was 2,000 years ago or 4,000 years ago. Lord, it is stunning how still today, if we would take the principles that your Son taught us and that his followers taught us, or the predecessors to us in the Jewish faith taught us, it's amazing how often those are the very same things that we need today to have great marriages and great relationships and awesome families. And Lord, I pray that this would be that your church in general, the church, and then because of where you have shepherded me, that this church would be a fantastic example of great marriages. Thank you, Father, for the opportunity to be a part of that ministry in your Son's name. Amen. Many of you have heard me say from the pulpit, it will come out probably once a month as long as I am preacher here, some version of the fact that I do truly believe that the main reason we lose kids when they go off to college, very often has less to do with liberal professors or anti-Christian professors or beer or drugs or sex and rock and roll or any of that kind of stuff. And it has more to do with the fact that parents' marriage stunk. And they get out of that home, and for the first time, they feel free of the oppression, the anger, the constant criticism, the sense of responsibility for their parents' emotional well-being, etc., that then causes them to flee at the first opportunity. The first time somebody gives them another choice, they choose that choice. And it's totally understandable. If you grew up in a household with a terrible marriage, of course, that's going to seem that way. There are a lot of things we can do, and I will tell you not only from experience as a therapist, but from personal experience, that it's also not too late to begin to model a healthy relationship between yourself and a child's parent, even if you're not married to them anymore, to do your best to be a part of that, to model that. And so if you're going to be married, there's some principles that I want to jump into, but there really is a sense to which if we want to revolutionize our country, if we want to see an awakening in our country, I think it will come through not necessarily Christian teaching, but through Christian marriages and Christian families. Because even lost people who are angry about the church are desperate to see healthy families. They want to have a good marriage. They want to have a good family. They want to do well with their children. And so that's something that if we can take these biblical principles and learn to live them out well, it's shocking how much that will change stuff. I really do believe so. So here's where we're going to start today. Probably not where you expect, but we're going to start today in the book of Luke in chapter 10. So I'm going to start in Luke 10, and I'm just going to teach through this passage. And I am also, as we're getting more and more and better research, and Millie's going to talk some about this next week, but the research base that is being done, so for the first part of my marriage, and if you've been married longer than 25 years, the first part of your marriage, what you had in Christian publishing in regards to marriage was really almost entirely hit and miss. It was just as likely to be a curse that would undermine your marriage as it was to be a blessing to encourage your marriage. So I strongly recommend avoiding Christian marriage books published before about 1995. Now, some of them are pretty good, but you don't know. You may get one that will destroy your marriage. You may get one that will undermine the concepts of healthy marriage. That's not the fault. It is the fault of the writers. I don't mean to say that, but it's not their fault that they were trying to help. They really were. And some of them, again, some of Smalley's books. I think some of Smalley's books were very valuable. John Trent, some of his stuff was very valuable. But every bit of it you have to filter because it's based on just their opinions about marriage and very anecdotal, the therapy input they had or whatever. But of course, you could have good biblical teaching on marriage, and you can go back 2,000 years and get that. And then, so feel free to go back and read commentaries on Ephesians 5 and 1 Peter 3 and other passages about marriage. That's great. You're doing well with that. But understand, it is amazing how often that I've had to do almost trauma therapy to help people unlearn stuff that was taught to them by Christian publishing and Christian teaching sometimes in the 1970s and 80s and 90s. Again, I am sure, I feel totally confident with everyone's best interest at heart that they were trying to do that. But the idea that marriage is fundamentally about needs, and the way you affair-proof your marriage is by meeting your spouse's needs, and that those needs are something that is just being listed out with essentially no research, in my opinion, has devastated Christian marriages. It's one of the things that some of the stuff I teach is because of reading stuff further back than that and more recent. Whereas we have great materials now between John Gottman's research, Shante Felden's research. Felden is overtly and right in your face Christian, great material, and it's all research based. Gottman is less overtly Christian. There's kind of debate on how to handle some of his stuff from a Christian perspective, but there's a lot of truth in it, and it is very much so research-based material. There's just too much good stuff out there now to learn from, to risk going back further, my personal opinion. So when we're going, so you're either good going back the last 20 years or 2,000 years. So I'm going back 2,000 years, and I'm going to talk about some of these principles starting in this passage. Ready? And behold, a lawyer, verse 25, where I'm starting. And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And so just to lay the groundwork here, we have a lawyer. We're starting with a lawyer. Here in the Greek, probably meaning a student of the law, an expert of the law. Don't think of it as someone who like goes into a courtroom to defend people. That's not how the legal system worked then. This was, if you had a question about the law, the local law, and almost certainly since it's a Jew, the Jewish law, you would go ask this guy. He's an example of that. So he stood up to put Jesus to the test. "Rabbi, what should I do to inherit eternal life?" So Jesus says to him, "Well, what is written in the law? How do you read it?" Great job, Jesus, returning the question back to the attorney here, right? And so he answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." Good attorney, again, a good lawyer, legal answer. He covers all his ground. He even kind of doubles up on a word to make sure that in the Greek it covers the Hebrew well. You've got some pretty good stuff here. This is the Shema. It is the correct answer to the question, what is the most important law if you're a Jew? This is the correct answer. Not open to interpretation or discussion. This is the correct answer if you're a Jew. What is the most important law? So he answers that. And Jesus says to him, you have answered correctly. Go do this and you will live. So the guy already knew the answer to the question. This is common in therapy. People come for tools. They already know all they need to know. Rarely is it a problem. Let me guess. I should be nicer to my spouse. Well, try that. See if that works, right? Okay, so. But he, the legal expert, desiring to justify himself, here meaning to be right, in order to prove him that he is right, said to Jesus, who is my neighbor? Now, what does he want to know? So it says, love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus says, do this. And he says, who's my neighbor? What's he trying to figure out? Who he doesn't have to love. That's exactly right. Who do I not have to love, right? Who counts? Who do I have to love? So that's the question he asked. Hold on to that question. Who do I not have to love? So Jesus says, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed on the other side, and so likewise a Levite. When he came to the place and saw him, he passed on the other side. Okay, just to lay the groundwork here. Jesus tells a story about a road that's well traveled. Thousands of priests probably lived in Jericho, and they walked or traveled to Jerusalem on a regular basis. Here you have, oddly enough, it's funny because as a kid, I was taught, well, this is probably, they're probably on their way to the temple and they're running late, etc. Like, it was always connected to the application was, if you're on your way to church and somebody needed you, you'd be like, no, I don't want to be late to church. They're going from Jerusalem. You never say that someone is going down to Jerusalem. You're always going down away from Jerusalem. So they're leaving Jerusalem, not going to Jerusalem. So they don't have a good excuse to not stop and help, other than the road from Jerusalem to Jericho was known to be a dangerous road. And stopping may not have been a good strategy. But notice, we know nothing else about this man who's been beaten, left on the side of the road, half dead. That's where we are right now. So Jesus tells a story. Guy on the side of the road, left there. Then you have these two people come by, the Levite and the priest. So the priest goes by, and they pass on the other side. Maybe this is a cleanliness thing. Maybe this is they think he's dead. They don't want to risk touching a dead body thing. Maybe there's some kind of religious motivation, but the truth is they just avoid responsibility. That's what they do here. But a Samaritan, as he was journeying, by the way, if you're a Jew, like they are in this audience, you kind of throw open your mouth a little bit when he says that. But a Samaritan, as he was journeyed, came to where he was, and he saw him, and he had compassion. He went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, set him on his own animal, and brought him to the inn and took care of him. And the next day he gave 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back. Okay? Jesus tells a little story. He acts like an old man, even though he's only like in his early 30s at this point. You know, you ask a simple question, you get a long story out of it. So he tells a story. But look at Jesus' question. Which of these three do you think proved to be the neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? Is this what the man asked? So what does the man say? The one who showed him mercy. And Jesus says, same words, almost the same words. Go and do this and you will live. Right? You go and do likewise. Same thing he said before. But now he's told a story in between. The man asks, who is my neighbor? And what is the answer Jesus gives him? Who are you neighboring? Is what he answers. Who do I have to neighbor? Is what Jesus answers. What makes the Samaritan this man's neighbor? That he helps him. The Samaritan is who makes this injured man his neighbor by loving him, by having compassion on him. The story is not the story of who is the neighbor. The story is a story of who creates a neighbor. The Samaritan creates a neighbor out of this story, which is exactly the opposite of what this man says. Jesus is telling the man, it isn't based on other people whether you love them. It's based on you whether you love them. And that's what will make you their neighbor. Here's one of the things that struck me. If we just took the basic teachings of Jesus about being a good neighbor and applied them to our marriages, think how that would revolutionize marriage. So often what we hear in therapy and what we think as human beings is, what do I have to do to make my spouse a good spouse? How much do I have to love them? How do I get them to be a better spouse? You see, that's the question we're usually asking. And the answer I think Jesus would give, if he was following the same principle, would be, that's the wrong question. Not how do you get a better marriage, but how do you create a better marriage? You create a neighbor by how you treat your spouse. That's what determines whether they're your neighbor, is how you treat them. In my mind, I think this concept is what most people are getting wrong in marriage, is that they're looking at marriage and trying to figure out, how do I get what I need? Which is essentially, well, for a Christian, nothing. There's nothing marriage can offer you that you need if you're a Christian. All you need if you're a Christian is Jesus. You don't even need food and air and water and shelter and clothing. Humans, Christians can live without those. I mean, we die, but then we live without them. So it's as Christians, even as humans, the things that we need is a very short list. It's amazing how often we apply the word need to stuff that what we mean is what I want or what I like or what I prefer or whatever. But regardless, we're trying to figure out how do we get a good marriage versus asking ourselves constantly, how do I create a good marriage? How do I create a great marriage? What decisions can I make to do that? What gets in the way of us creating a great marriage? What do you think? What are some of the things that get in the way of us creating a great marriage? I dearly said, not counting selfishness, but because obviously that's going to be the major one, right? Okay, laziness. Yeah, it takes work. Yeah. Okay, defensiveness. You need to justify yourself. Right. Okay, good. What else?
Children.
Yes, okay, right, children. The lack of energy that children create in us. We've talked about that multiple times in the past. If you haven't seen them yet, what we did a couple of years ago was a two-hour conversation on sex in marriage and how by far the primary issue in regards to sex in marriage has to do with the lack of energy in marriage. And the way men and women engage with that differently. And the truth is that children are just vampires that suck up all the emotional energy in the marriage, all the psychological energy. That's why marriage satisfaction scores are what we've shown that plenty of times. But for those of you who haven't seen, they usually start relatively high and then they drop off after 2 or 3 years and then they climb and then they drop back again and then they climb. And it is trackable almost without exception according to the age of your children. It turns out your dissatisfaction in your marriage has essentially nothing to do with your spouse. It is all about your kids. Right? So they don't have the energy to love you the way you like. You don't have the energy to love them the way you like, the way they like. And that creates crisis in the marriage for sure. So children. So laziness, the lack of energy that children represent, the fact that we are selfish, that we want to take care of us rather than them. Anything else? Okay, that we have expectations, right? That we have certain things laid out there, right, that we want to have and that we feel justified in not responding to until those expectations are met. That's there. Yep, poor communication or sometimes too much communication, right? Communication is always a bad idea. Listen, if it wasn't for communication, there would be no problems. So ask any man. We will back that. It's like, problem is that we talk too much. Anyway, okay. Kind of kidding. Not entirely. Okay, different priorities, right? different preferences, even. Like, I don't like the same things you like. I don't want to do, if we have a certain amount of time or a certain amount of energy, I would rather spend it on this and you would rather spend it on that, right? So here's what's intriguing. And I've gone over this before, but let me go back over this a little bit, is that I really believe that the purpose of marriage, that the way God designed and created marriage, was to be a living parable of God's love for his people. That's why he created it the way he did. It's what he created it to do. Again, if you've been married more than a few years, you have learned that marriage is an awful way to get your needs and wants met. It seems to fail at that pretty much without exception, to get your own needs and wants met. Being married to another human being is pretty much a constant disappointment. And which is okay, by the way. We're big boys and girls. We can be disappointed. Disappointment is hardwired into human life. God intended for us to be disappointed. It was never his goal for us to feel at home here. And so of course, no one could ever achieve everything we would want all the time. This is not possible. And we're not going to do it for them either. So understand the disappointment is a natural, normal state for humans. And you're going to relate to another human, of course they're going to disappoint you. That's a given. Deal with it. But the idea here that God has created this system that is really good. So if you wanted to create a system that required you to give what you need and want in an effort to help somebody else sometimes get what they need and want, then marriage is a great setup for that. It's a great way to spend the rest of your life sacrificing for someone else. As if it was created and designed to do that, which I believe it was. It's a living parable of God's love for his people. God's love for his people is best defined by the cross. Best described, best shown by the cross. So, of course, he has hardwired sacrifice into marriage. He requires it. It is what makes marriage work. Compatibility does not make marriage work. Compatibility may or may not, depending on who you ask, make marriage easier, make marriage a little smoother. But the truth is, you're going to find something to disagree about with any other human that you live in an intimate relationship with, right? In fact, you're going to find numerous things. If you've ever lived with a roommate who you were not married to, you found things that you disagreed with them about. And so when you walk someone on your identity, when you guide someone across your identity, and then you ask them to guide you on their identity, which, by the way, that's the definition of intimacy, is to guide someone onto your identity and have them guide you on theirs, so that all becomes kind of common ground. As you both explored this together and you know each other, that creates a sense of knowing each other, hopefully, if you're willing to do it and willing to lead them and willing to be led by them. But that still is going to be, the more you know them does not necessarily mean the more you're going to like them. The more you know them, the more you're going to see things you like and the more you're going to experience things you don't like, right? It's a given. One of the things that's shocking for people is when they come in for counseling, and one of the things that's always been intriguing to me, different things surprise me differently than normal people, I've realized over the years. And so the first time that someone made a big deal about, like, we always fight about the same, like, three or four things, and I'm like, right, and we keep going, and I realized, oh, you meant that was a problem. Like, you wanted to engage with that. I'm sorry, well, let's go back. What do you mean? And like, well, there's these three or four things, and it seems like, you know, we talk about it, we fight about it, we get on the same page about it, and then 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, 6 weeks later, we're fighting about it again. Actually, I had a woman say one time, I don't know if he's mean or stupid. The two generous options, right? I don't know if he's mean or stupid, meaning he knows this is important to me and he's not doing it. Is it because he's so stupid that even though I've told him 1,000 times is important to me, that he still can't learn it? Or does he know it and he's just too mean to do it? Which is it? Well, what's wild about that is, and by the way, the answer is probably some version of both, mean and stupid, just like you are. But here's what it comes down to is of course that's the case. So I use the example all the time that my wife is a monotasker and her... what she loves is my undivided attention. She's an undivided attention person. She loves getting undivided attention. She loves getting undivided attention. She loves nothing more than eye contact and there to be nothing distracting at all. Like, this is how she communicates love best to her. Now, we're very, very different on that. Now, the reason I'm making that as an example is because if we were the same about that, there would just be something else. This is just one over 25 years that has become something that we have spotted over and over and over again. So again, it's not that there's any special about that one. If I was also a man, I can't wait to just sit perfectly still and focus on just one thing and look you in the eye and just like that's what I would love to do, then we'd be fighting about something different. But we're the same on those things. Of course, we only fight on the things that we have differences on. I don't know why that's surprising. Like, what did you think you were going to do? Fight about the stuff you agreed on? Like that? How are you going to manage that? So of course that's, and I charge a lot of money to give someone my undivided attention. Some of you know that. I charge a lot of money for that. It doesn't come naturally to me. That is work for me. I have to be paid to do that. And so to focus all of my undivided attention on somebody, and even then, those of you who are clients of mine, like you'll notice sometimes that I'm like, you know, got an extra little piece of paper on my notes that I'm jotting little other, because that's because something came to my mind. And if I don't jot it down, now I'm going to be sitting and thinking about that rather than you. So I've got to like, sorry, jot. Okay, keep going. Like, oh, jot. Like, anyway, sometimes that's even just good marriage stuff. Like we're talking and you'll say something like, I just wish my husband would do this. And I'm like, that's a good thought. Like, do that. That would be a good thing to do. Steal that idea. Like that's anyway. So, but that doesn't come natural to me. Every single year, those of you on the leadership board can say, I think every single year, almost every single year, some version of, Chris, you still have work to do on managing multitasking and giving people the attention they need. I think pretty much every year that's come up on my evaluation. I don't think it's going to change. Hopefully I'm getting better at it. It's never going to come naturally to me. I am not wired to that. I get bored easily. And so I have something else and I need to, that's just how that works. That's my wiring. So what happens is my wiring isn't going to change and neither is hers. You're talking about a woman who turns down the radio to get onto the interstate. I mean, she can only do one thing at a time. And so I'm eating a bowl of cereal and reading a book and texting while pulling on the interstate with my knee. And so that's only a slight. Anyway, my kids are always like, Dad, you're going to kill us all. Anyway, I literally am that dad whose teenagers get onto me about doing stuff while I'm driving. How about that for, I know it's dumb. You don't tell me. I know. But so this is that's going to come into conflict between us. And she's going to say, now early on in the marriage, how did that play out? It played out like this. She would say, why don't you ever pay attention to me? Would you just, she'd be talking. That's how it would happen is she would be talking. I'd be listening. And then she would suddenly stop talking. And I'd be like, what? And she's going, you're folding laundry, right? Well, I wanted you to listen to me. So I'd sit down and like do that, thinking the whole time, hearing about it. Half of what I'm hearing is white noise. And the other half is laundry needs to be done. And so, because I do better if I distract part of my brain, I listen better if I distract part of my brain. And so this is that comes naturally to me. So she would go, why don't you ever do this? You know, this is important to me. And I would say, what is it with this one thing? I mean, I do all these different things and you keep coming back to this one thing. Why don't you focus? I'm so unappreciated, right? And that's how that conversation would go. She would attack me and I would defend myself and we would. And then what happened one time is, because I'm a trained therapist. And so I finally caught this pattern. And she said, you know, why don't you pay attention to me or whatever? I really don't know if I went first on this or she did, but we're going to say it was me since she's not here. So she said, so why don't you pay attention to me? And I said some version of, oh, yeah, man, that just doesn't come natural to me. Sorry, I'll work on that. I didn't. Defend myself. There was no need. By the way, what was I going to defend myself against? That I don't do that? Oh, I don't know. Who are you talking about? That didn't sound like me at all. Yes, it does. It sounds exactly like me. Sounds like everybody says that about me. This isn't, if I don't know that about me, I'm the delusional one. I sort of go, wow, you're right. I will work on that. Now, if you've been married more than a few years, you know what happens. I'm a good husband. I love my wife. I want her to feel loved by me. So I say, you know what? When I get home every day, between then and at a certain time, she and I are going to go for a walk. And we're going to go walk. She'll have my undivided attention. And I'm just going to listen to everything she has to say. And I'm not going to be able to do anything else or whatever. And so I'm going to initiate it so that she knows this is important to me. And so we go for a walk. And then we go for a walk the next day. And then the next day something comes up and we don't go for a walk. And then we go for a walk the next day, but then we don't go the next day. Or the next day. Or the next day. And I totally forget. And I go back to what comes naturally to me when I'm tired, hungry, angry, lonely, bored, pick it. We always go back to what comes naturally to us. Because everything else requires energy. To do something that doesn't come naturally to you requires energy. If I don't have much energy, then I go back to what comes naturally to me. And the next thing you know, she's trying to talk to me. And I'm playing Farmville and doing dishes at the same time with a video going over here while listening to her. And she can go, what is it with you? You still don't get this? Or she can do what she does now and go, hey, remember, it's really important to me when you're able to focus. Like, that really means a ton to me. And I can either go like, what is it with you? And always throwing fits about this one thing. How come you can't focus on all the good things I do? Which, how dumb would, like, how come you don't, like, make a point of being constantly saying all the good things? Like, does anyone do that? That's delusional. Of course not. No one does that. It's good if you can. Appreciation's a positive. But, of course, you notice the things that hurt or bug you more. And so she would... So now we've got this pattern where, and I can do better. By the way, and she's got three or four of those, and I've got three or four of those. Here's what's wild. If we follow Jesus' model even in this one, and by the way, my favorite marriage verse in the whole Bible is actually in Matthew chapter 6. Do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth, starting verse 19. Do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, and thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourself treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. Here's the verse. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. This has become by far the most practical advice for marriage that I've ever read anywhere. So you'll know, this is not a nice thing to say about us. There's nothing sweet or kind about this. If we were a neat people, then he would be able to say, your treasure will follow your heart because you're just that high quality of people. But that's not what he says. What he says is, you're mercenaries. Your heart follows your treasure. You're essentially little emotional prostitutes. Your heart will follow your treasure. So you better decide, one, where you want your heart to go, and two, you better invest treasure there. If you do, unless Jesus is lying, your heart will go there. It has become the most practical advice for marriage I can ever give, is when I ask people, what are you doing right now to invest treasure in your spouse? Not your family. That's good, and that's all. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. But treasure invested in your family is not identical to treasure invested in your spouse. Treasure invested, how are you investing your treasure? Your time, your money, your thought, your strategy, your energy. How are you doing that? Most of us cheat our spouse and the relationship of marriage first. It is the first thing that gets cut off. We will cheat our spouse before we cheat our kids, before we cheat our work, before we cheat our church, before we cheat our friends. We'll cheat our spouse. I don't mean cheat on them, Lord willing. We will cheat them. I only have 10 points of energy. I can invest that in my spouse, or I can invest that in returning emails. Return emails. I can invest that in my spouse, or I can invest that in my kids. I'll go read a book to the kids. Now, of course, there are times you have to do that. But if you always do that, and you don't put any energy or treasure or strategy or thinking or planning into your relationship with your spouse, then don't come whining to Jesus when your heart is not with them anymore, because that's what he told you would happen. It is as practical as it can be. So one of the cool things about Ginger not being here is, so for the last, I mean, since I realized the reality of this, I discipline myself. Now this doesn't, it's kind of a sad thing. When you say nowadays, I discipline myself to love my wife in a certain way, that feels unromantic. Let's get past that. Okay. Romance. I'm a romantic husband. My wife would tell you that. Any of my friends who know me would tell you that. And let me just tell you, to be romantic requires work. Romance does not happen naturally. Yes, those of us who are good at it make it look natural, but it's not. Never is it natural. By definition, it means especially those things that she knows I'm doing only for her. And the way she can know something is only for her is if it's something I don't care about very much. And so by definition, being romantic is to do something for the other person that they know isn't what you would choose on your own. So that's always going to require work. It's always going to require strategy. It's always going to require thinking ahead and planning and all that different stuff. So a few years ago, when I really began to uncover this and think how I could apply this to my marriage, I decided I'd written a lot of poetry in college. But once I'm married, you have kids and you have a job and all that kind of stuff, that requires a lot of mental energy for me, and I don't have a lot of that left over. But I decided, you know what, I'm going to write a very sweet, romantic poem for my wife. And it took me a while to do it. But what I would do is I would keep a notebook in my pocket, and sometimes when I was just sitting and looking at her, I would jot notes or right after a conversation with her, I would jot notes or that kind of stuff. So it took a year and a half, but it was in my pocket the whole time. So she got a good 30 minutes total. Maybe she's read it a few more times since then. So maybe a total of 2 or 3 hours worth of love and affection for me from me writing her that poem. But I got 2 years of investing treasure in her doing it. Spent close to 2 or 3 years, because I'm old enough that most of our photos are like actually pieces of paper. And so I had to go back and find out to create a photo album for her. Now it took forever to do it and to get to even to learn how to use whichever website it was that I used, and to create this big book and to put them all there and to move them around and try to find certain, like at some point I realized we had most of the kids' Halloweens, like a picture of every, like apparently you take a picture of your kid on Halloween. I never think about that, but apparently we did every year. And so it was cool to get to put like a few pages in a row that were nothing but Halloween shots of our kids as we had more and more kids, and they're wearing the other kids' last year's costume that we dug out, and they didn't know. And so do it, like I spent, I don't know, hundreds of hours creating this. I mean, she loved it. It was great, but its value in our marriage was primarily about me spending the treasure. Because I would be sitting somewhere giggling under my, under my breath, laughing about the fact that she's frustrated with me for not coming downstairs faster with the kids. She's like, "What are you doing up there? Like, I'm just working on something." But inside I'm going like, "I'm making a photo album for you. That's what I'm doing." Like, the love would grow in me. My affection for her would grow while I'm doing this, even though she didn't know about it. Let me just tell you, this teaching, which Jesus is talking about the kingdom of heaven, it applies to marriage. If you will put your treasure in your spouse and you begin to do that, when you feel less love and affection for your spouse, the natural temptation is to pull away. Bad idea. Instead, what you do is you go, you know what? How do I plan the date of their life? How do I plan the weekend getaway of their life? And you don't have to tell them. Tell them, listen, book this weekend. I'll take care of all the details. And then you plan that. I've done that in therapy with couples before where the wife doesn't even know. Because people come into counseling and go, "I'm not in love with my wife anymore. I'm not in love with my husband anymore." And you're like, well, I mean, right. You're in counseling. Like, no one shows up and goes like, "Man, I'm just here to hang out because I'm crazy about my life. It's awesome." So it may mean that. Maybe you have those feelings or whatever, but to go, "Hey, how do I fall back in love with my wife? Well, let's plan a weekend. You and I, we're going to plan a weekend for you and your wife. And you're not going to tell her what you're doing. We're just going to plan this." And as you plan through it, you see them get excited about doing this thing, because it turns out marriage is a living parable of God's love for his people. And God's love for his people is defined and described best and portrayed best by sacrifice. And so we're always supposed to be looking at our life going like, what could I sacrifice for them? Now, granted, some of you are married to narcissistic and abusive people. This is all going to be turned around on its head if you are married to somebody with a personality disorder. There's going to be issues you have to deal with that, because your efforts, they're going to interpret badly. You have to learn to love the person without loving their disorder, and that they may not appreciate and understand that. If you're married to somebody with a disorder like that, you're probably going to need a therapist to walk alongside you there to help you learn how to apply these principles in a way that will actually help your marriage rather than hurt it. That represents 10% maybe or so of marriages that have true disorders like that. But especially as men, if we will step up as men and lead in this and begin to do this first, very often, I think, which is the biblical model, is that our wives will begin to follow this lead. So that we would learn to, where our treasure is, to invest our treasure where we want our heart to be. And when our heart is there later, the fact that you had to invest treasure to make that happen doesn't make it any less real. Of course, it's there. The reason it was easy for your heart to be there with your spouse when you were dating or when you were engaged or whatever is because you were thinking about them all the time. And now there's a lot of other things taking your mental energy if you've been married very long. So you're going to have to be intentional to think about them and intentional to plan for them and intentional to that kind of stuff. Questions on that? Statement?
Sure.
There's something to that, sure. Sure, there's something to that that I'll repeat it. So the question or comment was, not only, especially as the husband, not only are you doing this investment, but by spending this time, energy, and money, the whole family is having to not spend that someplace else. So it creates a sense of the whole family being there in a way, serving and moving in this direction as well. And certainly that is the case. I would tell you that for the most part, you can do this well without cheating family. You may have to cheat work. You may have to cheat church, which if you need to cheat church in order to invest in your marriage, you have not only my permission, but encouragement, if not my straight up like accountability. You need to do that. The core of Christian community is not the church. It is the marriage. It is the family. And so you need to be investing there. And that's totally appropriate. Okay, so if this is the case, now let me wrap this up. Oh, yes, sir, sorry.
How can a spouse on their own make that determination as to the right place to put that treasure? If I'm trying to build credit over here for my spouse,
right.
That's not her priority. She doesn't see the value in what I'm doing.
Okay, good. Yes. It is important that you know your spouse well enough to know which things to invest in for them, right? And so there's a male-female thing here that's generally the case. This is about sacrifice. And so I might go, wow, what I would love to do is I would love to go on a hang gliding trip and, you know, in Peru with my wife, and my wife who doesn't like jumping over a rope would go like, no, I don't like getting on airplanes, and I'm sure as heck not wanting to, like, unless I believe God was calling me to lead my family in that way, I would never try to serve her with something that she would resent or regret or not want to do. And so I need to know her well enough to know. Some of the wives were like, "Hey, will you take me hang gliding in Peru? That'd be awesome." This is what I was going to tell you about. Actually, going to wrap up here is thank you for that segue. If you're going to love them well, that means loving them according to their passions and hearts and appreciations, that kind of stuff, at the expense of yours. So I used to have this really convoluted way of trying to explain this a long time ago. And I got done one day and Ginger said, "Can I give you some feedback?" And you love that. And so she goes, "Can I give you some feedback?" I was like, "Yeah." She goes, "That's really hard to follow. What if you just talked about like putting drinks in the fridge to explain the same concept?" And I was like, "Well, that would work like way better than what I've been doing." And so here's what's wild. So God says, this imagery that we're supposed to be sacrificing. We're creating a neighbor in them by giving of ourselves. We're creating something, not just waiting for something or drawing a boundary around that, but going like, no, I'm going to make you my neighbor by how I treat you, right? And so with that model, so if I say, here's what's wild, if you go, because if I go, listen, the rest of your life, living in sacrifice for another person, sacrifice your needs and wants for somebody else's needs and wants, you're like, that's not a very good, like, sales pitch for marriage. And it's not. It's still the truth. But here's what's wild. If you do this right, here's how it plays out. And this gets me kind of fired up because it's really cool. I consider this almost like a fifth classical proof for the existence of God, that marriage exists the way it does. So check this out. I'll do this quickly, but check this out. So we all prefer, I'm not going to ask all the questions because I'm going to move quickly. We all prefer a gift to a purchase. And we all prefer a purchase. No, all gift to a request and a request to a purchase. And so it's, if you have to pay someone to scratch your back, you will. But you would rather just ask and they scratch your back. And even the best thing in the world is when someone just starts scratching your back without you even asking. I mean, assuming it's someone you want to touch you. But you would say, like, this is a, it's just the best. If your spouse just starts scratching your back or something, you're like, man, this is the life, right? I mean, just when they do something for you, that's what we want with everything. If you say you want a new truck or a new car, what you mean is you want someone to give you one. You're willing to ask for it if you have to, and if you have to, you'll purchase it. But what you want, everything we say we want, what we mean we want is that we want it as a gift. There's not many circles in which you can do that, okay? There's not many circles in which you get things as a gift on a regular basis. But, so the example we use is, at the time, and again, this is a 20-year-old example, but that we would say, I like root beer, she likes Diet Coke, okay? And the reason it's such a good example is I think diet drinks are foul. I can't, like, they taste like a chemical bath to me. I think they're so nasty. And anything as sweet as root beer is just gross to her. She's like, I'd rather Cairo syrup would be less disastrous to me to just drink it straight than something like, so we don't like the other one. So when I say I want root beer in the fridge, what I mean is when I'm thirsty, I want to go to the fridge and open it up and there's root beer there. I didn't buy it. I didn't put it there. I didn't put it in the fridge to cool it. Nothing. It's just magically there when I want it as a gift, right? And when she says she wants Diet Coke, what she means is she wants it to magically appear in the fridge, that it's cold and it's ready for her when she's thirsty. That's what we mean. If I want something, that means I want it for free. I want it as a gift. Now, if I have to buy my own root beer, I can never receive it as a gift. The only way to guarantee that I cannot get root, by the way, this is all metaphorical, obviously, pick any aspect of marriage, communication, like for us, attention, sex, you name it, everything applies in this way. What you say you want, what you mean is you want it for free. You want the other person to seek it out for you. So if I do my job and I stock the fridge with Diet Coke, because marriage is a living parable of God's love for his people, and God's love for his people is defined by sacrifice. I don't like Diet Coke. I only have enough resources, metaphorically, to put one thing in the fridge. And especially when you have kids, you don't have resources to serve one person often. And so I put Diet Coke in that fridge, which means there's a good chance that there are going to be times in my marriage when I come to the fridge thirsty and all that's there is Diet Coke. And if I'm the only one who does my job, that's what's going to happen. But if both of us are doing what God has called us to do, then both of us are getting our needs and wants met in the way we want them met as a gift. God has created a hedonistic system where we get what we want the way we want it, but only by not seeking it. That's stunning. That is ingenious to create a system that only works by not seeking it. Yes, sir? Yeah, that is the only way to guarantee it. If I can guarantee that I don't get it as a gift if I buy it. So my main in marriage, it becomes, I am living out this picture of God's love for his people by saying, how do I make sure that my wife is served the way God would want her served? And you might go, well, what about you, Chris? And I would say, not my problem. That's between Ginger and God. I'm not called in the Bible to serve me, at least very little. I'm called in the Bible to serve her first and then others. And so I serve her. And my, quote, needs, roll I roll here. My quote, what I mean is my wants and desires, that's it, when it comes to marriage wants and desires, those are between Ginger and God. Now, I can be your inside information source, right? I mean, she can be my insiding trader that I go like, hey, I bought you some flowers. And she goes, those are beautiful, but I like yellow flowers better than red flowers. I mean, that's not criticism. That's her doing sneaky insider espionage, right? She's like, I know you bought those for me. You're trying to get points because you don't care for flowers one way or the other. And so you must have gotten those flowers for me. So I'm going to give you insider trading advice as to what kind of flowers I like best. That's not her being selfish. It's not even her requesting something. It's just her giving me a little internal espionage for how to do what she knows I'm trying to do. I mean, think about how that applies most powerfully for those of you who are married, how much that has to apply, for example, in the bedroom. That the other person is the only person who knows how something feels to them. So they have to tell you. They have to be your guide. They have to be your trainer. They have to be your teacher. And so that's true there. That doesn't just there. That goes everywhere. So when your wife says to you, hey, I think you're following that car too closely, or you scare me with the way you drive, that is her way of saying, this is a way you could love me. That when I'm in the car with you, that you drive more carefully. That would communicate love to me. Instead of being defensive, guys, our answer ought to be like, sweet, thanks for the low-hanging fruit. Like, that's an easy one. All I got to do is back up a little bit and you feel more love. Easy, right? Man, there are hard things. That ain't one of them. So this is anytime we hear that from one another, we can either interpret it as criticism and be defensive, or we can go, oh, yeah, that sounds like me. I guess I could make a little change on that. And then you won't. You'll forget, and you won't do it well, and they'll have to remind you again at some point. But that's because they're on your team. If you're on the same team, it doesn't have to be defensive like that. No one gets this exactly right. Everybody messes this up on a regular basis. But these two fundamental concepts, am I willing to create a neighbor in my wife by the way I treat her? I'm willing to do it with total strangers. Why wouldn't I do it at home? Well, because we're lazy and selfish and we have different priorities and we're egocentric and we're childish and we're... But those are not good things. So as we're trying to follow Christ, if we try to create his model for this, we are creating a neighbor at home. And by the way, guess what? They're going to disappoint you. And if you're doing it so that you get payment back, you're going to be doubly disappointed. Because you're going to have standards and measurements and expectations that they're not going to meet. And then you're going to feel even all more upset. You're not serving them. You're serving God. You don't answer for them. They're not your boss. You don't answer to them. In judgment someday, I will not stand before Ginger for what kind of a husband I was. I'll stand before God. That is both freeing and terrifying at the same time in appropriate ways, I think. So this is the picture I want to create, is that we become great neighbors. And in fact, who we are the best neighbor to would be our spouse. And that therefore we seek to do what, to invest our treasure in them, because it's part of God's calling, as an expression of investing in God's kingdom, so that our heart stays with them and continues to be with them. This are two simple principles. They're impossible principles, but two simple principles that mean the difference between a marriage where your hearts are intertwined and the natural state of marriage, which is divorce. So unless you're putting something into it, it's not going to make it. So there's so many different resources out there. On the website, I even have like a resource page for books about marriage and that kind of stuff and parenting. I have a lot of articles there. We have numerous sermons and Wednesday night series. All the Wednesday night series about marriage in the past are on the website. Many sermons on marriage and marriage stuff are on the website. And there's just so much good stuff out there nowadays. It's just unreal how many excellent podcasts. I mean, the opportunity to have the training and information, you could listen to new podcasts and new ideas and new thoughts that would be good forever, much less therapy. Now between like Aletheia, Jennifer Wood is here. Jennifer Wood has a counseling center here in town. And there are plenty. Am I missing somebody? I thought I saw another local counselor walk in. Okay, guess not. This is your chance. If you're here, wave at me. Okay. But there's so many great resources out there. Across the street, Bethel has a counseling center. Green Acres has a counseling center. There's so much good opportunity out there to follow through with this if we're willing to take it. I mean, we say this is like the most important relationship in our lives, right? So that we probably should be studying and reading and learning and improving and getting better at this all the time. So I really want to encourage you with that. All right, and I want to pray God's blessings over us because this is a ministry, which means it's beyond us. It's more than we can possibly do. And that's why we rely on grace as we seek to live out following Jesus in regards to our marriages. Father, thank you for the good gift of your Son. And thank you that your Son, in purchasing us, in sealing us, in choosing us, in adopting us, in making us his own, then set us free to do all kinds of good works. And God, protect us from the temptation to only do good works for people who are happy with us, or who like us, or who don't know us well enough to be disappointed with us or frustrated with us. Lord, I pray that you would teach us fundamentally that we would confess to you, and there may be people here who've never done that, Lord, and who need to confess to you that they want to, moving forward, do marriage your way. Not as an opportunity to get, but just like your Son, an opportunity to sacrifice and to give himself for us. Or as an opportunity to be like the church and to, with a great commission with the Son, make an impact in the whole world for eternity. And God, I pray that our marriages, that the marriages that come out of South Spring and other churches represented here tonight, that these marriages would be vibrant, growing, imperfect, but grace-filled marriages, so that people can see the problems and the errors and the flaws and yet will experience the grace and the love and the forgiveness that comes from seeking to invest our treasure in what you would have us invest our treasure in, the things that last forever. And for all of us who are married, our spouses are one of those things that last forever. We're all eternal beings. God, I do pray that as we develop great marriages, those will also be an example and a testimony first to our own children and grandchildren and the families around us in the church and in our community. God, I pray now that whatever you lay on people's heart here, that they need to respond to hearing a different vision maybe for what marriage can be and ought to be and could be, the good gift you've given us of a constant Christmas morning of new gifts every day. When we do it your way, I pray that we'd have the opportunity to live that out. Thank you, Father, that you are such a good God, that you love to give good gifts, even at the systemic level. Thank you for marriage. For those who aren't married, thank you that you, in fact, in the end, are the groom for all of us. And that that transcends everything else. And Lord, I pray that you would give each of us the desires of our heart as we pursue you in your Son's name and through the sanctifying power of your Spirit. Amen.